Hello and welcome to the latest episode of If My Feet Could Talk. You'll have to excuse my voice. Just spent a weekend in London, and the air quality is so much different to what it is down here, and you notice it when you go away. So I'm a bit croaky, but I'm all right. Negative across the board before anyone thinks otherwise. So I'm your host, Owen, and I'll bring you another episode of If My Feet Could Talk. And it's pretty much the Christmas episode, really, because it's almost Christmas time. In a few days' time, it's going to be Christmas. So by the time I've recorded this and all this sort of stuff. So let me first wish all my listeners and viewers a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And can I say, if there's any of you that will be alone this Christmas, and would like to have a chat, just send me a DM on one of my social media pages, and we'll have a chat. I know it could be quite a tough time for a lot of you. So, yeah, send me a DM and we'll have a chat. So a little catch up with me. I'm on day 948 on my run streak as we record this podcast. I've just come back from a weekend in London. So it was a brilliant weekend, caught up with my best mates, stuff like that, and had a great couple of runs whilst there. The air quality is, it's rubbish, really. Apologies for that. That's just an email that's just come through. I had a great couple of runs whilst there. And speaking of London, that brings me on to my next guest. He's an inspirational runner who I've got to know through social media, following his adventures and stuff like that. We have each other on our Facebook and stuff like that. But he's not only overcome adversity pretty much most of his life, but he has achieved some amazing things in the world of running. So it's my pleasure to give you Tom Garrett. Okay, here we go. So good afternoon, Tom. How are you doing? Is all things well with you?
Good afternoon. I'm really good, thank you. Good. Happy days, mate. Happy days.
So
living the dream.
You're sunning it up at the moment, aren't you?
We're luckily in Tenerife, so apologies if there's any kind of background noise and people walking past, but yeah, we're in Tenerife. We've been here for about just under 2 weeks. We came back to London for 2 weeks, and before that we were 2 weeks, literally 4 days after I finished the long last double, we flew here, so I had to elevate my big fat ankle on the plane, which was quite fun.
I am not jealous at all of where you are right now, I could tell you that.
Like the UK, mate. I love the UK. It's my partner that likes the sun.
Well, sometimes a bit of sun's good for the soul, isn't it? So,
oh, hell yeah, definitely. I agree that.
Just don't get enough of it in the UK. That's the problem.
No.
So, for those who don't know you, Tom, can you give a little brief insight to who you are and what you do?
My name's Tom Garrett. I'm an ultra runner and personal coach, coaching more holistically rather than physical as well. I've been ultra running since 2012. Before that, I did the kind of usual thing where I was kind of partying when I was younger. But I've had a few kind of health things going along the way. So ask any questions you want. I had stage 4 cancer, encephalitis, being abused and bullied. So I've had my fair share of bumps, but it kind of got me almost mentally prepared for ultras, that when you go in a dark place and you think you're going to break, it's the mental stamina and the mental endurance and visualization that pull you through. I think that's what a lot of sport is about. It's a lot to do with mental strength as well. So that's what's helped me endure the long distance events that I have put myself through, I think. So, and I do it all to raise awareness for cancer or testicle cancer. So, yeah.
So you're quite a busy man in various guises, I suppose you could say, from running as well as obviously raising awareness, mm-hmm. and coaching and stuff like that. But if we go back all the way to your childhood, I know it's not that far away. You're still a young man, obviously, you know. Normally I ask about growing up, but your start to life wasn't as smooth as a child, was it? Can you just give us an insight to what it was like when you were a baby?
Yeah, I mean, I was 22 months old when I got diagnosed with post-viral encephalitis, which is an inflammation of the brain where I couldn't, I kind of had to take steroids when you're younger. Obviously, you know, when you're in a medical condition, you get given steroids, and then obviously not the steroids that make your muscles big. They're crazy, man. I mean, yeah. Obviously I was 22 months, so I didn't really understand what they were. I was still a baby, so... I couldn't walk until I was about 4 or 5, but it was really, really hard for my mum and dad, I believe, because I have a sister who's 1 year, 3 months older than me, but before both of us, my parents had a child, and she unfortunately passed away before me and my sister were born. She passed away very, very young, so it was kind of it really shook my parents up, that because they thought it was similar to what happened before my sister. That was when I was 22 months, and then about 5 years old, I had an operation down in my testes, because my testes were what's known as undefended. Normally your testes are a certain depth from away from your groin, and they were too high, so they had to be lowered. And there was an operation to lower them. So that was quite young as well, so I'd almost built up resilience without me knowing it. It was almost like, you know, and when I was at school, it wasn't great for me, because academically I struggled a lot, and I was in, my girlfriend always said, don't say you're in special classes, but I was in classes wherever they weren't as quick as regular kids. I had to have a tutor. But the sport was one thing that really made me be accepted. I was let down numerous times by friends and things. So I attempted to take my life when I was at school, because I was just really unhappy when I was younger, didn't really fit in. I was accepted very much in sport, which I kind of thought, okay, people are actually talking to me now, because I was good at sport, national cross country. Played hockey for Southeast England, Middlesex, played for one of the top team in the country at that point called Teddington. On the second team, I wasn't old enough and strong enough to be on the first, but I was videotaping years ago, guys, before iPhones, we had big fat cameras. So I was recording those from up high. But that was pretty much school, but I got abused by a gentleman that lived opposite the school. Because a few of my friends just knock on the door, and the guy pulled me in, and that wasn't nice at all. So that's kind of pretty much when I decided to try and take my life, because I thought, well, my friends have battered me, I thought they were friends, and then this guy across the street from the school did this. What's the point? That was my school.
Your childhood, sporting aside, I mean, you mentioned obviously you wanted to take your life, and having stood there as an adult in a similar place, it must, especially as there was no real support, because this is quite a few years ago, child mental health wasn't really spoken about, and because adult mental health was still taboo back then. There must have been no support and stuff for you. So you mentioned sport basically saving your life. Would you say that is the case?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, mental health is one of those subjects. Even today, it's still, people want to talk about it, but they don't want to talk about it. It's sometimes on their terms, but not on their terms. But yeah, I mean, in a nutshell, yeah, I think it did. It did. I mean, I don't think it did. Fact. It made me happy. It made me sane. It made me just think about stuff on a level that was happy endorphins, you know? So, yeah, that was it. Definitely.
As I said, we always go off on a slight tangent on this show, but if you were to meet your younger self now, so say you went back in time or what have you, what would you say to him? Knowing what you know now,
I always say when when I've always heard people ask the question, I think I'm pretty damn proud of myself, to be honest with you, that you push yourself through. I mean, the fact is, yeah, okay, when I work with kids in summer camp, I used what I went through as a child and I helped people. I didn't just go off and do whatever I did, like run countries or whatever. That came later. But I went through a time of, you know, reconnection with myself, helping other kids. I did summer camps in the States. So I don't think I would possibly tell myself anything, because I told myself all that then.
Yeah.
I said, just keep going, just keep going, just keep pushing it. You're better than that. They're the weak ones. They're the weak ones. I didn't say to their face, but I said, look, the bullies are always the one that want to make themselves better, feel better by making other people feel worse. And that's the weird way of looking at it, is I had sympathy for them on that sense, because they need the kick for themselves to make other people feel shit. But they don't do it individually, face to face. There's always another person with them, because they need to show off to that other person. It's never one-on-one, because otherwise it's, who are they going to make feel good apart from themselves? It's, if it's face to face, it's always another person as well with them. But you know, a lot of kids, when I was bullied at school, when Facebook came out, a lot of them connected with me, and I kind of friended them anyway. And they said, look, I'm really sorry how I treated you as a child. You know, I was really bad. I feel really bad about it. And I was like, no, fair dues. It made me the person I am today. So in other words, it kind of helped me benefit other kids when I was in summer camp and I was an au pair. So yeah, I just keep going. Just keep showing up, you know.
It's the old saying, wasn't it? You used to say, sticks and stones break your bones, names never hurt you. I remember when I was 6 years old, we moved down from Wales to Cornwall, and I was on the school bus going home. And I remember the kids my age calling me a sheep shagger because I was Welsh. I mean, I don't know what that was, but it was hurtful.
Yep.
A six-year-old shouldn't even know what a sheep shagger is, not alone use it. You know, and bullying still goes on today, sadly, doesn't it? You know? And I think
I got bullied when I got a qualification for my coaching. But the thing is, right, the bullies are always the weak ones. I mean, you talk about mental health and mental health, regardless, however, when you say it wasn't that going on there, but even now, you go on social media and you put something on like a pig carrying a tray. People will go, ha, ha, ha. But as soon as you put something on about which is sensitive, which is kind of a bit, you know, people don't know what to say. As some people just don't know what to say.
Yeah.
So they don't say anything. So that's the reason why it's kind of like, but it takes courage and takes guts to connect. I mean, sometimes when I put stuff on Facebook or any social media channel, it's normally the same people that will comment on it or like it. And a lot of them are women. Because with guys, sometimes it's very much like they've got to be stronger, they've got to be more. That's what trouble I have with the testicle cancer awareness. They don't talk as much. Breast cancer's massive, unfortunately. Yeah. But 1 in 2 people will get cancer. And people don't talk about it enough. And you need to talk. But people have an ego. And they don't want to be weak. They don't want to seem like there's something going on. But the strong people are the ones that talk about it. I mean, there's but once you talk about it, you kind of feel like, oh, you feel so much lighter when you get it out. I mean, I'm getting goosebumps just saying that because it's fact.
Yeah.
As soon as you talk about it to someone, if they're real friends of yours, real friends, they'll listen to you. Not talk, they'll listen to you. If they say, I'm busy, are they friends or not? Because if they're really friends, honestly, this is quite deep, but if they're really, really good mates, they'll sit down and have a chat or ring you up and see what they can do, if they can help you. But that's, you find out when you're going through shit, who your real mates are. I'd rather have very few mates than a load of friends that kind of talk to you whenever they want to, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I agree. If we roll back to your childhood, were you, obviously you mentioned you did sports as a child, was there any family members that were sporty that sort of influenced you in the world of sport?
Not really. It was just, I mean, my mum, family member, my mum was, she went walking a lot. She was a doctor, general practitioner. My dad was worked for the Department of Trade. And my sister was academic, a little bit sporty, but not as crazy as me. I mean, I was pretty loopy when I was younger. I went quite a few things when I was younger. One of the kids that kind of got bored, got really good, but got bored, went on to something else, got bored, went on to something else. But no, not really that I can remember. I mean, when I was on holiday, like say in Tenerife, like we are now, I used to kind of, my dad and me used to be kind of standing up like this. And we used to kind of run and do that. And we used to pretend to chase each other. But not really. I mean, my dad used to play golf and cricket. I mean, they're not real sports, are they? I mean, you're talking about rugby and, you know, we're from Twickenham originally. So rugby was a big deal when we were younger, because it was obviously not professional then. So they kind of, one of the ladies that worked with my mum, she was married to Brian Moore.
Oh yeah,
who's obviously ex-England and
yeah.
So I mean, that was a game where you sort of, well, you can have a job. My God, they're so good, but so professional. I mean, that game in itself, I think rugby is a very, very good sport to watch and admire people on the pitch and off the pitch. They really conduct themselves on the pitch, especially while that, is it Nigel Owen, that referee?
Yeah.
The little guy, he's like, don't we? But they're really good. They're very professional and they're respectful, both on the pitch and off the pitch. And that kind of almost was something I admired from sport, where you treat people with respect as well. So, and they were strong as well. But there was no one really family-wise. I don't know where they are. I mean, my parents say, I don't know where you get it from. Definitely not the long distance.
So, well, that's it. So it's obviously, it wasn't a genetic thing or an influence that started getting you into this sort of field of things, as it is with some runners. But you started triathlon at a young age. How old were you, and how did that come about?
Well, I did lots of sport. Like I said, I did martial arts, cycling, and I did something called the London Youth Games, which obviously there's the whole, all the London boroughs, and they, and you basically get selected within the borough. If you get people that come and see you, like agents or people that come and come coach you from different teams, etc. But I was a member of a triathlon, a cycling club in Twickenham Cycling Club, and there were some really, really professional top cyclists there. And a couple of them did triathlon at a local club called Thames Turbo, which was in Hampton Pool, which was an open air swimming pool where we used to go as kids. It's open 365 days a year, and it's beautiful open pool. It's just over 20, it's like 35 meters, which is really weird for a pool, but it was just really nice to go there. And they were having a triathlon club there, and I got, and it was only kind of open for a year or so, so I got interested in that, and I saved up for a bike, and then I got pretty good at that. I was winning a lot of under 18 races, under 17 races. There was a chap called Stuart Hayes, who was the domestique for the Brownlee brothers in 2012. He was the other guy that basically got them to their positions. He was training in the same club, as was Tim Don, who was like multiple Olympian champion, world champion, world record holder. So I was quite good at that when I was younger. But then again, I took my bike into Kingston. And very naively, I left it and I didn't lock it and it got nicked. And there was a time when I was kind of, I don't know whether it was a sign or not, but I basically got it. But I was really good at it when I did it. But that was a life change, that was after that. But I was really good at it. I really enjoyed it. And it was, but I was one of those kids where I just got bored and moved on. Whereas I'd never change anything. I mean, there were times in your life when you look back and go, would I change anything? But then if you stick to one sport, that's kind of all you know is one sport. Whereas it's like when I go to ultras, would you stick at one distance, or would you see what you would achieve? Because if you're later on in life and you try 5 down the years, my God, I'm actually really good at that. You never know unless you try it. If you stick at one sport, you kind of get really good at it, but then you would look back on that and say, I would have been really good if I tried that. So I don't think, is anyone really happy with what they did when they were younger? But then we wouldn't turn out the way we were if we did what we did. So there's always things you would change, but I think triathlon was really good for me because it was, you know, you kind of didn't get bored because you had to swim, cycle and run. So, but I still haven't beat my 5K time from when I was younger.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive time. But
I did 17 something when I was younger in 5K, which is quite good.
Well, you don't focus your training on that now, so you know.
No, exactly. It's a different energy system as well, different muscle fibers.
Definitely. Normally a 5K is a warm up. So
exactly.
You were under 18 then, and then you stopped sport for a while, didn't you? Why was that? Was it just because you wanted to enjoy life?
Yeah, I think it was just one of those things. I mean, I like music a lot. I think, you know, music was quite a big part of my life before that. I mean, I never listened to music when I went running and cycling. It was always detached. Kind of like going back to when you were younger, you kind of, you know, you live in the moment and don't get distracted. You just, you know, you're cycling outside and you hear the birds, the wind, everything like that. I never listened to music. But I started, you know, got insurance on my bike and bought some 1210s Technics and started DJing. But it was the world where everyone wanted to DJ when I was younger. So, but I started working in nightclubs and started to play a little bit in some of the clubs and started to do house parties and things like that. But and then I was working at TGI Fridays, which was an old American institution. But back then it was very, very good place to work, good training, and I was really always good with people, like quite good banter. And but I did that for a while, and that was then I started working in hospitality, running bars and training people. And
when you were in TGI's, were you flipping all the bottles around like cocktail?
Yeah, I was a very good tosser.
I remember going to, because there used to be a TGI's down in Covent Garden. I remember
this. Yeah, it's the second one opened in the UK. Yeah, it's
late 90s it would have been. And I just just sitting there mesmerized as these guys were flinging bottles all over the place. I was thinking, wow, this is Tom Cruise shit going on here. This is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, literally, it was a really good place to work. I mean, some of the guys that, there's a bar company called Beat at One, which you may have in, it's kind of going on countrywide now, but that's run by two guys that used to work in Fridays in Kingston, where I trained. Well, I didn't get trained. I trained by observing people. But yeah, I worked in Haymarket, which is opposite the Planet Hollywood that used to be in Trocadero. But that was when Americanisms in the UK were quite, oh my God, what's this? But now it's kind of done and it's everywhere. And it's, yeah, but it was a very, very good place to work and installed a lot of decency when I worked in the industry. So yeah, it was a good place to work, but it was cocktails. It was all about the chat and about theatre rather than just about, you know, knowing everything about what's in a bottle of gin. I mean, you can look at that online, but you can't get the chat, you know.
Yeah,
that's what I did. That's what I was good at. So yeah,
and this then obviously sort of had a halt in it back in 2004, and you've already sort of mentioned it in your intro. You became quite ill and was diagnosed with cancer. So do you want to explain what happened there?
Sit back and take shock. It's not a pretty one, but the thing is with cancer is that when I was working in nightclubs in the West End, I got back pain, upper back pain, chest pain, but it was a great time for me to work. But then when I was diagnosed, it was basically, they were told, original diagnosis was on the 15th of November, 2004. And they said, look, you've got 3 days. We don't think you're well enough to freeze any sperm for potential IVF later on, because it takes 3 days to do the test. And we don't know whether you're going to make it. They didn't say you've got 3 days, but you know, in that's a nutshell, what they said, look, yeah, we recommend you start treatment right now. But I was basically working in the West End in a nightclub in Regent Street, and I had back pain there, upper back pain, yeah, chest pain, and then I started to get tender breast, and you could literally squeeze and stuff would come out my nipples, which is, I don't know what, it was like pretty rant. And but I basically went to the A&E in East London and visited an A&E, and they, 6 hour wait, they gave me tablets and said, look, it's fine. Chest x-ray, blood test, they said it was normal. I didn't cry wolf when I was younger because my mum was a GP, as I said before. So I wasn't one to kind of go, oh, this or that. She would always give me these magic pills, and obviously they were paracetamol, but everything was kind of fine. But I kind of rang my mum, who's visiting my sister with my dad in Australia, saying, look, something's going on here. I'm a bit worried about it. She went, okay, we're coming back tomorrow anyway. So in that week, we saw my GP, who was the daughter of my GP from when I was younger. So obviously people listening to this will know that some doctors, unless you've known them for years, may miss certain things because they're not passed on. But she knew me from when I was younger. And basically I had understanding testicles, as mentioned before, which is quite a big alarm bell for testicle cancer. So anyone out there that knows anyone with understanding testicles, please, 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 please contact your GP and get yourself checked, please. If you're not sure about their prognosis or diagnosis, please ask for a second opinion and get it done because it's worth it, 100%. But we saw another doctor because we asked for a second opinion. That doctor said, look, calm down, Miss Garrett, who's my mother. And she said, look, don't tell me to calm down because I know what's wrong with him. She didn't tell me because she didn't want to shit me up, which is really decent of her because, I mean, even if she had, I wouldn't have worried because it is what it is. You can't do anything about it.
But it must have been harder for her being a GP as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and your mum.
Yeah, it was flashback to when I was younger and back to her first, back to my mum and dad's first child. This again, it's like, bloody hell, how many scrapes do you want, Tom? Do you know what I mean? How many lives do you want to take, you know? I can't imagine how hard it was for them, but she was, basically we got a second opinion and they said, calm down. Look, we can get you a specialist appointment in 3 months. And my mum went, he won't make next week unless you get an appointment right now. And so she walked out the surgery, rang up a friend of hers who used to work at West Middlesex Hospital, works at West Middlesex Hospital in West London, saying, look, this is what's happened. I think the next day, literally, we went into West Mid. I think it was on a Friday. An abnormal blood test, abnormal chest x-ray. You're not leaving this hospital. You're sick. So that was on a Friday early evening, which is probably not the greatest time to be in the hospital because on a Saturday, Sunday, nothing can be done because there's normally one doctor running around the hospital trying to help everyone. So God knows how it is for them now. It must be horrible. But basically, the following Monday, 15th of November, as mentioned before, you're really sick. We don't know whether you're going to make it or not. And then they did a brain scan on that day. And then my dad came out of the theater with me. And I was obviously under the knife and said, right, we've done a scan. Okay, your dad's going to give you the result. And my dad just quivered on his lip and went, they found it. They found it in your head. They found what we didn't think you had for 27 years. They found your brain in your head. And I just went, oh, you bastard. My dad's quite a joker, you know, but yeah. I wasn't initially worried or scared. I know this may seem a bit like, yeah, right. You were just told you won't make it. But it was one of those things that I did nothing wrong. It wasn't self-inflicted. I didn't look up in the sky and go, why me? Because I don't know what it was, because maybe when I was younger, I was bullied and I pulled through it. I tried to take my life on, I pulled through it. I got diagnosed with encephalitis, pulled through it, even though it was almost like a subconscious endurance had been built in me because of what's happened in my life. And I went, okay, just make me better. Do what you can. But it was also the fact of, my life outside was okay, but it wasn't great. And I felt as soon as I went in hospital, everyone gave a shit about me. Everyone cared about me. Everyone was going, "Hi, are you okay, Tom? Are you okay?" And it was kind of nice because I hadn't had that in my life that much. You know, it was almost like a lot of bullying, a lot of this, a lot of being let down by by friends, by best friends, taking, you know, girls that I was interested away and all this kind of stuff. So it was kind of being cheated on by a lot of other people. And and I was going around all the wards, just chatting to all the other patients with my drip. You know, literally not being able to walk very well, but I was chatting to people, just finding out about them and about each other. So it was a nice place to be. I didn't find it that bad.
Yeah, I mean, it must have still had an effect on your mental state and your physical state with everything that was going on, you know, relationships, family. Obviously, you pretty much die in.
Yeah.
So that must have been tough to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't sporty because obviously there was a transition from when I stopped sport to when I got sick. So I wasn't the healthiest chap. I was, you know, doing naughty stuff, smoking a bit and all that kind of jazz, as some people do with, you know, having a drink and partying and stuff. But, you know, if you don't live your life, how can you pass on your experience to when you have kids and whatever, what not to do, what to do or whatever, you know, just otherwise you're just going to be a, you know, you can't pass it on. And but there was a time, well, you probably read about in a ward in Hammersmith Hospital called Daisy Ward, which is, oh my God, they were the best people ever. I thank them so much. They were all really small people, which is quite interesting because I'm 6'2", and when I took a picture of myself leaving, they were all like 5'2". So I looked a giant, but they were amazing. I was in hospital there for 3.5-4 weeks. And before the treatment, I was basically told that I could die having the treatment. And when she said dying, her phone rang in the hospital, in the room, and she picked up the phone as soon as she said dying. And my mum and me just looked at each other and went, huh? And then she put the phone down and went, right, where was I? And I went, I could die, apparently. And my mum just laughed because I'm quite, like I said before, it is what it is. But the diet, that treatment was harsh as hell. It was basically, they take all your stem cells out, put a huge whack of chemo in, hydration and food, and then they put the stem cells back in. And that's where the side effects happen. And you can choose to ask what the side effects are and they can tell you, or you can choose to kind of have a bit of fun and see what happens. Because in life, going off subject matter, 99% of the things everyone worries about every day doesn't actually happen. So every time I worry about something, I think about the stem cell transplant, thinking if I would worry about something that may happen, it didn't. So I've just wasted all that energy worrying about something and it didn't happen. So I basically sat there thinking, right, side effects, just write down, just went about my day, and then the side effects started to happen, and everyone's experienced an ulcer in their mouth, like here. They were everywhere in my mouth. Oh, my lip, yeah. Upper lip, cheeks, here, bottom and top of tongue. There's not a place where you could put another ulcer. And literally, I was talking like this the whole time. I couldn't speak. I couldn't talk. I couldn't eat. I couldn't brush my teeth for 3.5 weeks. I couldn't leave the room. It was isolation. Pretty much, COVID is obviously hitting the whole world, but literally we were in a room where everyone had to wear a mask, gloves, aprons, hats, be tested before they came in to see me. So it was pretty, yeah, my immune system was completely shot. But there was no obviously social media now. So when you're online now, you can connect with people world that are going through similar things. There was nothing like that at all. It was so bad. Not even Only Fools and Horses made me laugh. And that's the best comedy show in the world. And that I didn't find it funny at all, because it was just, I was just broken. But there was one day where I was broken, like really bad. And I just literally just banged on the chair thinking, I just can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. And I was given Valium, which is an antidepressant they give to people in prisons. And they said, do you want to speak to someone? I said, I just need a minute. I was very thankful for the, you know, but I just said, I just need a minute. I'll be okay. And I basically talked myself round and said, look, you know, what doesn't break you makes you stronger. What doesn't break you makes you stronger. And, but the funny thing was, I couldn't move. I was in isolation, couldn't talk. But out the window was Wormwood Scrubs Prison. Yeah. Very, not very nice people in there. And there's me behind the wall. I can't move. So it was quite funny being there. But they were,
probably had more freedom than what you did. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They were outside and walking in the yard, and I was there, just stuck there. I can't move from here. But that was not very nice treatment. But also, I was walking down the street in my local area called Twickenham, and I was having nosebleeds. Just literally, I would be walking down the street, and my nose would just go because of the immune system.
Yeah.
I was making sure if. It looked pretty much like when COVID first started, I went across the street from other people because my immune system was not good, but I just couldn't stay inside because I just go fucking mental. So I was just making sure I was in parks around, you know, no one else. But I was on steroids again at some points in the treatment. And that is, if anyone's gone through steroids in their life, like not just the anabolic or whatever, but they're horrible, man. They're absolutely horrible. But if anyone's gone through it or going through it right now, there is a light big time. You just need to keep showing up every day and you'll get through it. Literally, you just sit there and you feel absolute shit. But you've probably got a question coming up saying, would I do anything differently in cancer? That's the one part of my life that I'd probably change. I would write a journal, or I'd write about it every day, like get a book and write about it every day and express myself that, because that's the only regret I have in my life is writing a journal throughout my cancer. But I'm trying to relive it and I've started to write a book ages ago, just writing notes when I kind of remember stuff. But yeah.
Because I remember when my best mate was going through his cancer treatment, it was too late by the time they diagnosed for him. It was more treatment to prolong life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he was in such a bad way all the way through that, like you were. Excuse me. I remember just seeing him the same way you described yourself, you know, but he got to a point where he could no longer fight and that was it, you know, but he was given 3 months, he lasted 2 years. So we had bonus time with him. And then unfortunately he left behind two young babies and a wife. So I put myself on a similar playing field with him during his fight. I ran miles and miles and miles so I could feel a bit of empathy with him, you know, the pain that he might be. Without giving myself cancer and going through that treatment, you can't, unless you've had it, you can't sympathize. You know, you could probably go, oh, yeah, I sort of understand what you're talking about. So this was the closest way I could feel what he was going through. And
you didn't you didn't feel like in any way you were punishing yourself or anything like that. You just wanted to feel like
I wanted to feel a little bit how he was, you know, him battling every day with the pain and the mental struggles and everything else, that was the closest I could get to it, you know.
You wanted to be closer to him, I think. That's one way of doing it. I mean, when he was, unfortunately, now he's gone, I think you wanted to feel that pain so you're closer to him. You're still there with him. You're still living with him. He's there right next to you all the time, every day, mate.
Oh, definitely. I mean, he's my guardian angel. I talk to him all the time. But what you were saying about, you know, the doctors and getting the second opinions and stuff like that, you know, by the time he got that opinion and that diagnosis, it was just too late.
What kind of cancer was it?
Esophageal cancer.
Esophagus, yeah.
He was a smoker and what have you, and a drinker, you know, standard 30-year-old, you know, ex-army. But he sadly lost his life. You didn't. You obviously, you've pulled through, you've come through. How long was your recovery to get to basically a point where you could actually go, you know what, I'm going to start to change things now, I'm going to get back into sport?
Well, firstly, I think I've got huge respect for you for doing what you're doing to kind of get kind of ideas and get stories out of people. So things don't, you know, the same thing doesn't happen to anyone else. And push, just going back to the important bit on this is push the diagnosis, keep hassling your bloody doctor, because it's, they've got hundreds of patients, you've got one doctor, one life. So keep pushing, hassle them and say, look, can I get it? Eventually they will say, oh, for God's sake, and do it. Because they don't do referrals enough as they should do. So push it, really push it. Don't try and be polite. Don't try and be British and try and be polite. Just push it. You've got one life, keep it and try and do the best you can, right? Knock on their door. I think with regards to kind of getting my journey back after my illness, I put it in a nutshell, just the first part of it. I lost my job when I was in, because I was general manager of a nightclub in the West End. I lost my job and they went into administration while I was ill. The new owners wouldn't employ me because of what I went through. Because that was very advanced, what I got through. It was very rare diagnosis. Normally, it's a lump in the testis, guys. So if you do get a lump, check it, compare it to the other one, get your partner to do it, your girlfriend, boyfriend to do it, whichever. And then if it's dilate, there's a link which we put in after to how to check yourself. But yeah, get it a second opinion or go and see your doctor ASAP. But I think after it was, I lost my job, went to work for a consultancy for a nightclub in the West End, because a lot of the other bars around the industry, it's quite tight and everyone knew each other. Yeah, yeah. So it's quite hard to get a job because they wouldn't employ me because of that. So long story short, I got that. Then they decided they couldn't afford me because it was too much money for them. Then I got a job for Gordon Ramsay. In Mission Star restaurants, which is a completely different part of it, but it was quite kind of Mission Star, but it was almost like quite relaxed Mission Stars. It wasn't kind of stiff. So I fitted into that.
Yeah.
But when I was there, my girlfriend at the time didn't really like it, but I just said, look, we need the money. We just got to, you know, this is my first job after my illness. It was almost like 6 months after my illness. I came out of hospital and we rented a flat. I walked into her with another guy, basically, 6 months after my op. So within a few weeks, I moved out, lived with my sister, decided to get a place in London. But then literally there was a balcony. There's these windows that obviously you can move like that and they don't move up.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I manipulated them to open them a little bit more, sat on the balcony with a pack of cigarettes, bottle of Jack, and got absolutely shit-faced and didn't really care if I fell or not. But then I edged more and more closer to the edge. And I just thought, what's the point? What is the point? I put so much into that relationship, so much into my work. But that's why you need something else in your life to motivate you guys and girls. You need that other thing, like a sport, like something else. I mean, sport was my other thing. If you're in a relationship and you've just got work, that's great, but you need something else to keep you sane, to keep the other person sane, to keep the work good and the relationship good. And that's what I didn't have. And because I put everything into it, being completely selfish, and that messed me up, and I wanted to jump, I wanted to end it, but something was stopping me. And I looked back on my life and thought, you just come out of this, you went through that, you went through this, because suicide is not, it's, you can't explain it. You can't explain why people sit on a ledge and want to kill themselves, want to end their life, but then you think, I think my parents, well, probably the main reason why I didn't do it and what happened when I was younger, because they just had a son that went through cancer. They just had a son that went through undescended testicles. So they just had a son that had encephalitis when he was younger, and they did so much for you to kind of get you to there. But then you need to kind of prove to other people that if you're on death's door, you got to go there to death's door, and then they're going to say, you know, why are you here? You had all this potential in your life and you just fucked it up. Why not?
Yeah.
The best thing in life is to, because when you're in rock bottom, the only way is up.
Yeah, definitely.
The only way is up. You'll never know what you can achieve if you stop. Always keep turning up. Always keep showing up. So literally, I don't know what happened. I had a kind of epiphany. I'm not massive with big words, but yeah. I try them every so often just to surprise myself. But I flicked out the cigarette, jammed a bottle of Jack, went in my bathroom, looked at myself in the mirror, went, you have to sort your fucking shit out. Sort your life out. Get it done. You know, because you're here for a fucking reason, mate. And you could stop people doing what you do. Because if you end your life, that's it. You get to the pearly gates and they go, what the fuck? What are you doing? You know, do it. And that's literally it happened relatively quick, but not quick, if that makes sense, because it's all a bit of a blur. But I've been let down a lot by friends. Like, I'm saying a lot, because I'm very patient. I have a very, very long fuse with people. If they want to talk to me, I listen. I don't give advice unless they want it. I listen. And that's what's not around as much is the ear. And I kind of went, I started running a little bit. I sort of thought, what made me happy? I thought, let's do triathlon, because that really made me happy. I was accepted then. And so I started doing 5Ks, 10Ks, started to join the triathlon club. But I was working in hospitality, so it was pretty hard. I mean, I was running home at 2 o'clock in the morning and starting work again at 8 o'clock. But then if you go into London now, so many people are running now after work. It's so good.
I was surprised actually at the weekend, because I was running around London, and there was more runners out than there was people.
Yeah.
I've never seen London like that before, ever.
Yeah. I mean, this was back in early 2000s. And because I started in May's in 2006. Because I came out of hospital in 2005. I had my operation, by the way, going back on the 7/7, which is the day of the bombings in London. And I was the only person operated on in hospital. And there's a chap called Tim Christmas who is up in the sky right now, but he did that.
Oh, that's nice
my
scar.
Lovely, famous cancer scar.
That's
he was the only guy in the world that did it.
It's a long scar. For those listening, it's a massive scar up his front of his belly, I suppose.
Yeah, they basically, there was dead cancer cells in my liver, kidney, abdomen, back of my lungs, so they had to get all them out. But sport was just the one thing that was sane again, because, I mean, Sports Personality was on last night, and it's the one, I love it, watching it, and it was just so... Watching all that last night just made me so good. It's just one thing that releases happy endorphins, makes you think, takes you away from all the other crap in life, and makes you come back and just go, right, okay. It's better than seeing a bottom of a glass, because a bottom of a glass it takes you into a world of, it contacts a different part of the brain, whereas it makes you happy, but it's temporary. And then it makes you kind of falsely believe you can do it. And then you kind of get sober again. And then that's why people get alcoholic, because they think they're constantly on the high, because it's almost like having sugar. You go, oh my God, I need sugar. But you constantly need sugar. If you drink, you constantly need a drink to keep yourself on the high. But that's when you turn a different thing into a high, being sport. And that's when it is. But That's what happened. I started to do, like I said, do triathlon, duathlons. And then I discovered an ultra triathlon, which was twice the amount of an Olympic one in Richmond Park. Sorry, duathlon. And then I just got an ultra distance triathlon, and then Ironmans, half Ironmans. And then a lady called Mimi Anderson, she was coaching, speaking at a triathlon show in Sandown Racecourse, and I thought that was a really good touch, having an ultra runner in a triathlon show, because it was normally triathlon, but sport is sport. You've got to blend the two. You've got to blend different sports.
Yeah, and Mimi is a phenomenal human being. What she's achieved over her life is just... Oh, you even for
and
someone
she only started
like
running pretty even, much when I started ultra running at 36.
Yeah, I mean, for the likes of you and me, even though we've achieved so much in our running career, we still look at Mimi and go, "That's just incredible. How has she done all those things in her life and known her backstory and stuff like that?" I interviewed her on here in the second series, and I've known her for quite a while, so I can understand why you got inspired by Mimi to do what you did. And you mentioned you stepped into the ultra running world. What was your first event and when was it?
Well, I got Mimi a lot to do with backstory, and I kind of like listening to her. She had a really good demeanor about her, quite calm. She wasn't big headed. She kind of did ultra running like majority of people that do ultra running have got a story.
Yes.
And otherwise they wouldn't do these psycho events. A lot of people have got a backstory to do it. My first marathon, competitive marathon, was in 2012, and that was London Marathon. And I did it in a morph suit, kind of head to toe morph suit, where I could dance with the crowd and have fun.
As you do, yep.
Yeah, raise awareness for cancer and stuff. And I did that. I did it in 4:20. But then the same year, I saw an ultra called the Grim Reaper.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, it's 40 miles, 70 miles, or 100. But you can do it in 28 hours. And I thought, well, 40 miles in 28 hours, anyone can do that. Walk it. 70, yeah, you could do that. 100, let's have a go. Let's try and do it. I dropped at 90 because I was too slow to complete it. But in hindsight, I wish I had, just on my own terms. But I was injured, and that's the only thing that stopped me. The following year, I came third or second in it, I think. I did it in 23, I think. But then that was started on a Friday, finished on the Saturday. But then the same event company had a half marathon on the Sunday. So I did that as well. I did it in just over 2 hours, I think. But I got Mimi Anderson as a coach, and I saw her. She had a Guinness World Record in Ireland. But pretty much every single year leading from 2012 to 2017 when I did it, built up to that distance. I was trying to find out.
Just leading up to... the Ireland record, you smashed in Centurion Grand Slams amongst others, which is a load of 100-mile events. How was your preparation going for this Irish record? Were you feeling confident now you had all these under your belt?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. I mean, I was feeling quite comfortable, and obviously you live and learn, and every race you learn something. You take three things you learn, three things you've done well. Because even if you won it or you came second or whatever, you still learn. But literally, I did Centurion Grand Slam, like you said, which is 4 lots of 100 miles in the year. And it's quite, they're very different events. One's flat, one's quite a bit undulating, one's quite hilly and chalky and wet, and one's kind of out and back, 25, 25, 25. But after the first 100 miler, I did, the second year I did 2015, I tried to do back to what, you know, like a Thames Path 100. And then I think a week later or 2 weeks later, I tried to do the Grand Union Canal. I thought, let's try and do the Grand Union Canal on tired legs. And I dropped at 85, I think. Because I had kind of pain in my shin, and the guy said, "Look, if you carry on, you may not be able to run again." I mean, I think I better stop then, because injuries are the only reason why I stopped. So I kind of thought, okay, you're a bit of a dick for doing that. But I did the T184. I did that, did really well in that, did that in 55. The following year, I doubled it, but the latter part was completely self-supported. I had to find water in that. But that was similar to, that was kind of almost a similar length to Ireland. And I thought, if I can double that, I can definitely do Ireland. So psychologically, I'd already built it up that I could do it, but I put it on social media that I was going to run Ireland in 2017, which was my 40th birthday. And I was going to start at the exact same time I was 40, which is 3:15 in the afternoon. And I put it on social media, and literally within an hour of putting it, my mum messaged me saying, you're not going to get the record. Mimi's an athlete. She's professional. Well, she's always professional. So, you know, do marathons. But I think she was just saying that just to be a mum and just stay safe, you know. But it kind of gave me a push to kind of prove people that have been doubting me. Not that she's ever doubted me, but it's kind of like install a point saying, yeah, I can do it. I'm going to prove it to all the cancer survivors, all the people that fight mental health, that you can do it. And you just put aggression into that than shouting at people, you know. And yeah, I did it. And I did it in, the main reason I did it for a Guinness World Record is to purely get more kind of focus on the website, which was bustingyourballs.org, which is a pure cancer awareness website. And we contacted all the Facebook pages throughout all the villages that we've got to run through, like running clubs or pubs or whatever, said, can we send you posters? And we had posters which were like A3 with the two blank bits saying, we're going to be in this town between this time and this time, and the town was blank. So we put whatever town we were going to go through. And they, when we eventually did go through them, they kind of had an idea of who, what I was doing, who I was. And the hits on the site were incredible. We got in the press, and it's kind of like, I know it's cliche and stuff, and people say, if I can help one person, but literally it wasn't about money. It's going back to the original point of inspect yourself. If you detect it, get it checked. And that was it. It wasn't to do with money, because I don't think it solves it. It kind of, if you get it checked early, you know, unfortunately, like your friend, you know, if you get it checked early, if you know people that do it, that's what saves lives. It saves time. It saves emotions.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we have a saying in the forces, you know, the six P's: prior preparation prevents piss poor performance. And you can use that in sport, and you can use that in life. If you obviously check yourself early and stuff like that, keep an eye on stuff, you can put in things, you can get yourself diagnosed sooner rather than later and all that sort of stuff. And then hopefully your performance at the end is unhindered, you know. Yep. Where if you don't do all that, then obviously, sadly, the ultimate is the worst case scenario. And you said you got the world record in the end.
Well, unfortunately, there was a gentleman who's a very good runner, who was a friend of mine on social media, who called Owen Keith or Ian Keith. I get the pronunciation wrong. He's Irish runner. He's a very good runner. He's done the spine numerous times.
Yeah.
And he knew I was doing it, and he messaged me and said, "Look, good luck in your prep. I'm thinking of doing it too." And he did it the week before me. And I was kind of a bit that he did it, but I didn't. I was frustrated, but not frustrated, because I didn't do it for the world record. I didn't do it for a time.
It was a bonus.
I purely did it because when you say you're going to do a world record, people want to talk about it. People get press, and people kind of go, "Oh my God, what is he doing it for?" And then that gets attention onto the website, thus increasing awareness, thus increasing detection, thus people talking about it, which is the reason I did it. I didn't do it for ego or gains or anything like that, or followers or anything like that. I did it to purely get people talking about illness. But he basically broke what was Mimi's record. Yeah. Mimi's still the female world record holder. He broke it, and I was a bit gutted. I obviously congratulated, saying, "Well done, da 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 da." He didn't put it too much on social like we did. Where we did it, every single link that we connected my son to was on Twitter, all over that. And then I beat the time that she got, which was my ultimate aim.
Yeah.
But since then, a guy who lives in Ireland has absolutely smashed it. He's done it in like 73.
Wow. That's mega.
I think, which is even quicker than Owen's one.
Yeah.
He did it. Yeah, but he's a guy called Gal, I think. He did it in like 73. He's from Ireland too. But yeah, that was purely to raise awareness, really. But it was an amazing experience. I had some really good crew that were amazing. It was filmed on a GoPro by one of my crew's sons, who was at media college. He did it on like GoPro and drones. So it was amazing. He got a lot of attention, which was the main reason why I did it. So
excellent. Yeah. So moving on more recently, there's a massive event. I say massive as in like distance more than amount of people that run it for obvious reasons. I knew Vicky who run it as well. Vicky Owens, she raced.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh my God, I saw pictures of her. I think it was she got taken. Somebody took a picture of her when she was sleeping on a bench, and she was like that. Yeah, that event will break you, man. But they did so well, those two, man. Oh, bloody hell.
Let's talk about Long Last, Gumdai, because it's 250 miles, basically. Yeah. And probably a bit more, probably a bit less, depending on your watch, isn't it? But we'll go with 253. It's still massive.
That's what Mark says. It says it on the medal.
I know. But it was probably a bit more, if you ask me.
I'll go with that one.
North Wales to South Wales via tarmac. So
yep, not pretty much,
office,
yeah.
Not the office dike or anything like that. It's from North Wales in Anglesey Way.
Yeah, it's Holyhead Port, which is the port that is a ferry that goes to Dublin in Ireland, all the way through Anglesey on a cycle route 8. So it's quite a popular route. So you can buy these books that have the Long Last Cymru map on them. They're quite famous. For all the cycle routes, so it's pretty well documented here. That's pretty much the route down the centre of Ireland. Down the centre of Wales, from Holyhead, Anglesey, all the way to upon the Menai Bridge, straight the way down through Snowdonia, then through Brecon Beacons, and then you finish off at Cardiff Bay in the Celtic Ring. So
first of all, let's talk about the actual race itself, because we'll go into there's a bit more to it. It wasn't your standard long last as the others did. Let's talk about the race. How did the race go for you itself?
Well, I did it in 2019, the first one, first prep, and I did it in 83.56, and I was pretty happy with that. But I was broken because the weather was
horrendous.
I mean, The weather in the UK, if it's bad, it's bad. But if it's in Wales or Scotland, it's pretty shocking, and it's relentless and it doesn't give up. So you've got to be pretty well kitted out. And so many people dropped in the first one. Only four finished in that year, 2019, out of about 30, 40 people that entered. And I, luckily enough, got four. But this one was a different mental preparation. Unfortunately, COVID happened, obviously, from 2020 and 2021. And I started training for this one in March, pretty much in March. So I only trained for six, seven months. But a week before the race, I got a bad chest infection. And even on the race, on the first and second day, I was taking antibiotics. But I did the race. I did it to raise awareness for cancer. For King's College Hospital, based in Southwest London. Fortunately, a friend of mine passed away, which is quite famous in the ultra running world, called Mark Thornbury. He lost his life.
He did.
As like a friend of yours, he beat the original diagnosis. He lived, unfortunately, a bit longer. But he lost his life last year, and that was to raise money for him. For the King's College Hospital, where he was treated. That's the main reason I did the event in the first place. I got a chest infection before the race. We started at Holyhead. The first day, I was literally trying to get through it. But I was stopping literally like this. Like that, every so often. Because obviously when you breathe like that, it's okay. But when you bend over, it's easier to open your airways more.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was a chap during the race. He hadn't seen me for ages and kept talking to me. And I can talk to people for as long as you want, but during the race, it's completely respiratory on your lungs. And I just said, look, mate, I can't talk anymore. And so he went off and he went, I'm going to try and sleep. I'm going to try and run for 50 hours and then I'll sleep. And I went, oh, good luck with that. But I beat him. he basically went on the first night. I was shivering. I was really cold because it was quite humid. It was like I said, in Wales, it's cold. Yeah, so
it was quite a warm October, wasn't it? Really?
It was 95% humidity. Yeah. People, when they look at the weather, they look at just the degrees. But if you go on an app and you look at the humidity in England, over here it's like 65% humidity, but it's like 21 degrees. But in the UK, if it's 21 degrees, it's going to be, humidity is so much higher because of the cloud.
Yeah.
It's a very moist environment. And it was very humid and sticky. And obviously, when you do ultras, you get this clammy skin. But I was doing that. And the first night, I was shivering, like literally chattering. And I rang my girlfriend up just to put a post on social. And she thought, why are you shivering? Why are you talking like that? And I went, I'm bloody freezing. And she went, no, you're not. And I went, oh, yeah, I'm freezing. So got through the second night as well. Got through the first night. The second day was struggle. But then I only started getting into the running at about 15 miles before Brecon.
Wow.
Which is, Brecon was a 200 checkpoint. Yeah. Just past Brecon was 200, just past the rugby club in Brecon. So about 170, 160, I kind of shook off the chest infection. And started kicking it and kicking people. Literally, I saw two people. I went past them, went around the corner, saw another two people. And I thought, okay, I need to lift myself up. I need to kind of make myself be happy. So I turned my light off and literally went like this. And it was about 7 o'clock at night, 8 o'clock at night. And it's, and they literally, I hid around the corner and they went, the fuck is that, and it scared the shit out of them, but it made me happy. And I ran past them and said, all right boys. But they'd overtaken me ages ago, and one of the guys was the guy in the first like 100 miles that had left. And I passed them, and we got to the last checkpoint, and I basically saw them. They caught me up, and then I left. And I said, you're right, guys. And they looked like wounded soldiers. And I said, well, I'm going to keep going. And I basically got to the Taff Trail after Merthyr. And the Taff Trail it just doesn't follow the Taff. Yeah. It just says, it's easy coming out, but going in, you're like, hello, you can't find it. Yeah. And I didn't sleep at 100, which was the first indoor checkpoint. I slept at 150, I think, for about 40 minutes. And then after that, I just had a couple of 10 minutes at the side of the road. I think I slept for an hour and maybe an hour and a half in the whole race. But eventually I finished third in the race. The two guys that came first and second ran together. But I think I looked at the stats after the race. And because you can see when you got to the checkpoint at what time and blah, blah, blah. And I was at Merthyr, and I was apparently, I can't work this out. It's really still messing with my head. I was like 7 hours behind the people at Merthyr. And it's only 25 miles to the finish from Merthyr. And by the time I finished, they finished at 11. And I finished at 2:30. So I made up somehow 3 hours or 4 hours in that time. How does one do that? It's weird.
But somehow autopilot.
Yeah, I came third in 79:34.
So
yeah, and I
253 miles,
4.5 hours.
253 miles in 79 hours, with obviously a little bit of sleep along the way. But you decided that's not good enough for you. You decided that you were going to run back to the start, because I know you left the car keys there or whatever. You decided to go back to the start. Why wasn't one enough for you? What drives you to do the double?
The reason why I did the double is going back to an illness, when you go through an illness, whether it's mental, physical, or anything like that, you're supported by friends and family, loved ones. If you're luckily enough to have friends and family and loved ones, some people are not. And doctors and nurses. But on the other hand, you're isolated in that this is your thing, your illness, your mental health, and no one will ever understand it. Even if they've been through it, it's yours, it's your story, it's your past, it's your thing. They can empathize and talk to you about it and relate to it, but it's theirs. So you feel very isolated and that no one understands you. So I wanted to do the race being supported as it was and on my own on the way back. So when I ran from, literally I finished at 2:30 on Sunday and then about just past 10:10 the following day, I started at Cardiff and to head all the way back to Holyhead. But it was literally with a pack, which was about maybe 6 kilos. I had to find my food, find my drink. There was no crew, no poles. In the original race, you get water every 25, drop bag access every 50. There's no crew, no poles, no nothing.
Because the race is over.
On the way back, I it was on my own. And I'm pretty strong on my own. I don't need motivation in the sense of, come on, you're okay, you'll keep going. I just thought a lot about Mark. I didn't know him as well as I wanted to because I met him a bit later on in my running. But I did it all for him. And when I had dark times in it, I literally just got up. It was all about putting one foot in front of the other. And just, if you looked at a train and near the stations and just went, well, that looks really warm, that train, that looks really warm, that looks really warm. Just keep going, keep going, keep going. And then I really want to get on the train. And then you're 5 miles past the train, but you're still saying, I'm not going to get on it. Because all it is how did you get through it? It was literally walk, put one foot in front of the other and showing up every day and not giving up. Pretty much. It was pretty brutal because I couldn't sleep in anyone's houses, any cars, anywhere warmer. And I have a radar key because it was my operation. He damaged my colon. So unfortunately, I need a radar key sometimes. And that was kind of quite a lifesaver because they were the only toilets that were, it was a stone floor. So it's fucking cold. And when I woke up, there's a bone here on your hip. And that was frozen when I woke up every day. Every time I woke up, I think I slept for about 30 minutes each night, 30, 40 minutes every night. Because it was, Wales weather basically said, right, you want to do long last, do you? You want to do the double, do you? You had nice weather on the first lot, do you? Now we're going to show you Wales weather. It was torrential rain, winds. It was pretty brutal on the way back, but yeah. Very different story to the
other. And it was uphill as well. It was all uphill on the way back.
Yeah, I mean, it was... there were times when I was doing the down bit from Holyhead to Cardiff where I was kind of thinking, right, I've got to remember the route back. Not remember it, but just remember the points on the way back to when there's going to be hills. But I did so much hill work on my training, so much hill work, because a lot of, if I can give out a tip to runners doing hill work, is that it's not all about running up when you're doing hill work. It's being very good at running down, because there's a lot of people in this race who are very good runners, but as soon as they run downhill, the quads just ache. Yeah. Really ache. I mean, my hill training is nice and easy on the way up and you go full on the way down. And that's where I built up my leg strength. I didn't find the hills hard at all. I just basically just went up them and it wasn't painful at all. It was okay. Completely fine for me. It was great.
But you did it. You managed to get back to the start and get yourself home. Which was nice. Well, big well done on that, Tom.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you.
It was great to follow yours and Vicky's races, and then obviously to follow you back up through the land of my father's. It's a beautiful place to run anyway.
Wales is, I mean, the one thing I need to go do is somehow, I'm going to do it again because the Taff Reservoir section, both times, even the 2019, I went through it when it was dark. I went, I can't see this. I need to go back there again and see it in the daylight. Apparently, it's very nice.
Right, we're going to move on to quick five questions. We'll get there in the end. So, question number one, your favourite snack on the run?
Oh, blimey. Bananas, probably.
Okay, question number two, do you have a favourite bit of kit that you always take with you on a race, on a long run?
I have two bits of, if I can mention two.
Yeah.
Is a buff and arm warmers.
Nice. Do you agree with pineapple on a pizza?
Do I put pineapple on the pizza?
Do you like pineapple on a pizza?
I'm vegan, so yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Some vegans still don't like pineapple on a pizza.
But I mean, it kind of eats away at your insides.
It does, but luckily, our bodies can cope with the enzymes that pineapples have.
Exactly.
Okay, if there was a song that would sum up your life, what would it be?
Oh, blimey. I don't know. You know this song by Kate Bush, Don't Give Up?
Yeah, nice.
I don't know. What that just came into my head now. But then there's the Queen, The Show Must Go On.
Yeah, that's a good one, yeah.
There's a couple of songs that like that. I mean, a lot of them are Queen. Just The Show Must Go On, literally just, yeah. Whatever happens.
Do you have a bucket list race?
Sorry, come again?
Do you have a bucket list race? The ultimate race you like to do at some point in your life?
Well, the Three Peaks is happening next year, and that's pretty bucket list. America's always a thought. America's always potential thought to run across that. I thought of running around the coast of like Scotland, Wales, England, doing that. But I quite like, I don't want to do just hundreds of Western State or anything like that, or UTMB, or I want to try and see if I, you know, the Three Peaks next year is 450, and that's over Scarfell, Ben Nevis, and Snowdon. That's pretty brutal. But I mean, me and Reece Jenkins were chatting about it and thinking, well, what do you want to do? And it just, there's not a specific race. It's just whatever your mind comes up with, because you can just do a race whenever you want. You can put your own race together, not where it's out there by people. You can literally just put one up and just go, right, I'm going to run from Land's End, Johnny Groats or whatever. But a lot of it's been done already. So I don't, I mean, the brain's still ticking over with that one, I think. But, okay. America's definitely a thought in the
process. What is your favorite race that you've done so far? One that will always live in your memory.
Long Lass. Okay. I like it because it's pretty just, it's, I like Mark Cockbane's events because they're pretty just minimal.
And out there, aren't they?
So, yeah, they just show, I mean, Vicky and Gordon, they were just, that is, generally ultra running in itself, just every race is so good. I mean, I like Mark Cockbane's events, but then again, James Ellison with Centurion, he's very inviting to other people. He puts on all the stuff. So it just depends what works for you. I mean, ultra running itself is just so bloody good because it's not about time like a lot of marathons and 5Ks, 10Ks. It's all about, did you get to the finish? That's it. That's all you need to know. It doesn't matter whether you came first or last, because it's all about mental strength and resilience and not giving up. Because, I mean, it's Sarah Morwood, just going off topic here, Sarah Morwood, who's an ultra runner, she ran a 50K, 50 mile of Centurion, and she gave her trophy to the back marker, to the person who finished dead last. But then you see these people in the London Marathon, they do it in like 6 hours. The people at the front couldn't be out there for 6 hours. They just couldn't do it, whether it's mental or physical, but it takes a lot of resilience and mental toughness, like Vicky and Gordon, to not give up, just saying, I'm going to get to that finish. And that's why people sometimes just have more kudos with the person that doesn't give up like those guys than the people that finish at the front, because it's a different kind of mental resilience, you know. So, and they didn't give up. They just, they, no one thought, I mean, the people that watched it going, oh, God, they're going to get there, and they're going to get there. They've got 5K to go. Come on, come on, come on. And they just got it. It was just so, I mean, Gordon and Vicky sent me messages after the race saying, oh, well done. I went, mate, hello. Well done to you. You've got the medal too. So, yay. I mean,
if you could run with anyone dead or alive, who would it be? It doesn't have to be, they don't have to be a runner. They could be anyone that you go for a run and a chat with.
I've thought about that question for bloody years, but I've never, there's so many people. I've never had a hero in my life, really, that I look up to, like, massively. I mean, I quite... I can't remember the guy, Shackleton, that's one person.
Yeah.
The explorer who just somehow navigated his way. There's one person that I never met who was my dad's dad. He would be one person that I'd like to see. Because he was kind of, when I speak and tell jokes and stuff, my dad says, oh, my dad used to say that. But I never got, he committed suicide before I was born. So I never got to meet him. But I mean, before obviously this whole controversy with Lance came out, I thought, oh, he was blah, blah, blah. But that kind of shocked me to the core, that did. I mean, that was a lot of people asked me that after when I came out of my illness and got into sport. A lot of people, press, friends said, what do you think of the whole Lance thing and that? And it was a bit like, you know, I'm still struggling to deal with that.
Yeah, you know? I suppose. Have you ever run the Southwest Coastal Path?
Southwest? I have not.
What's your favourite drink? It could be soft or alcoholic or...
Water.
Water. If you were to have a movie about your life, who would you get to play you?
Ryan Reynolds.
Nice, nice.
I like him, mate, because after Deadpool, he actually did an advert about checking yourself. Because he's just pretty, he's serious, but he's funny, but he's dry, and he's serious at the same time.
He's a good-looking bloke, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the end of the 10 quick-fire questions. So, obviously, you mentioned you're doing the Three Peaks. Do you want to just quickly talk about the Three Peaks?
The Three Peaks is Cockbane Events. Obviously, Mark as well, he's got quite crazy challenges going on. It's pretty much the same setup, but obviously extended. So you start at Fort William, which is in Scotland, nearest point to Ben Nevis. You go up Ben Nevis, down Ben Nevis, run all the way on the West Highland Way, and extended to Scarfell Pike, which is the highest peak in England. Sorry, Ben Nevis is the highest peak in Scotland. And then from Scarfell Pike, up and down, run all the way to Snowdon, up and down. Snowdon's the highest peak in Wales. And then I think they say you finish at the base of Snowdon or you finish a bit away from Snowdon, but basically it's completely, well, it's self-supported, as was Longlass. You get, I think, water. They're still kind of coming to, kind of, the rules are still kind of TBC'd. But it's kind of the same kind of setup, where it's water access only, I think, every 25 to 30, but there may be a cheeky little energy bar if it marks feeling if generous. Exactly. And then every 50 to 70 or 60, there's a checkpoint, but I think some of them are indoor, most of them are indoor, but it's in June. And it's about 450 miles, but no crew, no poles. Navigation is, they're going to do a GPS, but that's all in aid of King's College as well. So, yeah.
Cool. Do you have any tips for beginners starting running?
Be patient and listen to your body. A lot of people, when they start running, is regardless how much they've got on top weight-wise, your body has never run before. If it's running, if you want to get into running, start walking. Learn to walk fast. That will elevate your heart rate and get your cardiovascular system prepared for your running. Because when you run, your body's going to go, what are you doing? That's why your heart rate is high, because you could have anxiety getting used to it. So just be patient, listen to your body, work on strength and conditioning being your knee exercises as well, because your knees won't be used to the shock of that. So just get used to walking, walk faster, and then do a jog, run, jog, walk, jog, walk, jog, walk, and then make it, extend it. But just be patient. Don't think it's going to happen overnight. You know, because quite a few people, when I used to work in restaurants, said to me, I want to run 5K, 10K. I'm going to try and run it this week. And I went, it's great, but your body's never done it. It's like, you've got to train it. You've got to train it properly. But be patient, trust the process, don't trust the outcome. And it's a wonderful journey of discovery, not just mentally, but physically too. But you'll get there in the end. That's the advice. Just be patient and listen to your body, because but the results at the end are so good. Are so good if you get there. But yeah,
that's some good tips there. And finally, where can people follow your adventures and your craziness?
I have my ultra running tag on Instagram is Tom Garrod Ultra. That's TOMGARROD Ultra on Instagram. I have a coaching page as well, which is Tom Garrod Coaching, whereas I coach a lot to do with mental resilience, visualization, not just that I do programs for people, like custom ones, not just 6 months, 3 months, so it's all custom built for you, but it's a lot to do with mental health and resilience, and I can kind of give a 2-week rolling rota. You fill it in, I fill it in, and then you do the program. I do results according. I do your next program according to those results, and then you can contact me and talk to me about other stuff as well if you want to. But that's all included in the price. But yeah, it's because, like I said, ultra and sport is not just physical; it's a lot of mental well-being too. So yeah, that's Tom Garrod Coaching on Instagram as well. But the important bit is I did it to raise awareness for cancer. And there's a website called Bustin Your Balls, BUSTIN, yourballs.org. And that's a reference website. So if you go on that, you can find that information about testicle cancer, about what it is, how you can get it, if you can get it, if it's hereditary, et cetera, and how you can check yourself. So yeah, those are the handles.
Brilliant. I will chuck some of the links in the descriptions with this podcast. It's been absolutely great catching up with you, Tom.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you coming back to me.
Thank you for your time. And like you said, we've all got stories. Most ultra runners, I'd say 90%, yeah. I'd say 90% of us have got stories why we do it. And Dan Lawson said, and he's damn right, It's a form of self-harm, but with benefits. And a lot of us use it to cope with our stories. And again, the stuff that you highlighted about your cancer and cancer in general, if you said it's a cheesy line, you know, if it helps someone or someone can relate or that's listening or watching this, then that's only a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, one tip I give to anyone, regardless whether it's running or whether you're listening to this podcast, which, you know, I know you've probably heard it before, but what you do, you know, doing this podcast where you've done how many hundreds of episodes, when people listen to it, if they get one, what I like to call golden nugget of information that helps them make their life better or stops them from doing something which will end there, then God, I mean, well, the amount of people that you've helped as well. But one tip I would say to everyone is set your alarm in the morning. Don't set your alarm on a phone. Do it by crappy alarm clock for like £3. And then as soon as it goes off, stop it. Don't look at your phone. No looking at your phone. Go to a journal and write in it every day. Even if it's one word, Just go and sit somewhere quiet, outside, inside, wherever you want, and just write. But don't think about what you're writing. Just try and get as much out of your head onto the paper, and then turn it over, sit still for about 10 minutes, think about stuff, and then just get on with your day. But just try and reflect it and get it out into this book, because a lot of people worry about stuff a lot, but as soon as it's out on paper, it's not eating your mind inside, doubting yourself, because doubt will help. Doubt will hurt you. But anything is possible in your life. You just got to find the right way. I mean, everyone's got a destination which they want to get to. It's what route you choose to go down. But yeah, it's a wonderful journey if you make it, but just be patient and you'll get to where you want to get to.
That's amazing. Thank you, Tom. Much appreciated. For now, have a wonderful Christmas. We'll have a catch up afterwards, but have a wonderful Christmas. Love to you and your family.
You too, brother.
Hope you enjoy the sunshine.
Good health and happiness to everyone. Okay, Merry Christmas.
So that was Tom. What a phenomenal man he is. Amazing human being. And it just goes to show that humans can overcome adversity, can inspire and do great things. Whether you're lying on deathbed one day, to out then doing a double loss last can rye, you know, it's just mega. Really enjoyed that episode. But for now, that's the end of If My Feet Could Talk for 2021. Next year will be the next episode. So for now, happy Christmas to you all, and I will see you in the new year. You have been watching the Ultra Running Matlow. For now, bye-bye.